Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org. Additional support comes from the Jackson Laboratory, researching the root causes of cancer and other genetic diseases, designated a cancer center by the National Cancer Institute, JAX.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. To tweet or not to tweet? Is that even a question? Ahead on Only a Game, a social media expert weighs in on athletes and social media. Also, LeBron clears a big green hurdle. New York school kids discover the joy of bowling and batting on the Gotham cricket pitch. And a remembrance of golfer Sebi Ballesteros. Also ahead, Robert Lipsight tells the story of his accidental career as a New York sports writer.
I said, you know, Mick, I've never liked you. He raised his glass and he said, you know, that's the reason I became a drunk.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Memphis Grizzlies pushed their Western Conference semifinal series with the Oklahoma City Thunder to a seventh game by beating the Thunder last night. Game 7 tomorrow night will determine which team faces the Dallas Mavericks. The Mavericks advanced by sweeping the Los Angeles Lakers in the second round, which, according to Dallas Morning News sports writer Jean-Jacques Taylor, nobody expected, even in Dallas.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I would say Rick Carlisle and Mark Cuban didn't expect a sweep. I think that they thought that they would play well, and if they played well, they'd have a shot to beat them.
While the Dallas-LA series left lots of fans talking about the blatant fouls that resulted in the ejections of Lamar Odom and Andrew Bynum from the fourth and final game, or about the retirement of Hall of Fame coach Phil Jackson, Taylor chose to focus on what he saw as the main reason L.A. could not three-peat.
Kobe can't do it anymore. Is Kobe still a terrific player? Yes, but he just can't impose his will on a game and take over, because he tried to do that a couple of times and he had little spurts, but there wasn't the dominant, there's nothing you're going to do about me, I'm about to take this thing over, that we've seen so much from Kobe in the past.
Mavericks head coach Rick Carlisle had another explanation for the failure of the Lakers to win a game. He liked the way Dallas took advantage of what L.A. gave them.
We were resourceful and opportunistic in this series. And that's how you got to play, you know, when you're playing against a champion. And so I give our guys a lot of credit. We kept the game plan simple.
Simple, in the case of the Mavericks, involved tossing in 20 of 32 three-pointers during Game 4. In the East, the Miami Heat earned their spot in the conference finals by beating last year's NBA runner-up, the Boston Celtics, 4-1. According to Celtics head coach Doc Rivers, the Heat strategy was also simple. It was to get the ball to Dwayne Wade and LeBron James.
Those two guys are monsters, and when they're making shots, it makes it very difficult. The drives you can try to take away, but when they're making jump shots like they were, they're tough to beat.
The Heat became the team to beat before the season began when LeBron James made his spectacularly and ridiculously publicized decision to leave the Cleveland Cavaliers for Miami. Greg Cody, who covers the Heat for the Miami Herald, feels that now basketball fans everywhere can appreciate that much maligned and thoroughly ridiculed decision.
I think the rest of the country is sort of understanding why LeBron did what he did. You know, you can certainly begrudge him the manner in which he left Cleveland, but you certainly can't question why he switched teams, because he wanted to win a championship and he certainly has a viable shot right now.
To keep that possibility open, James and the Heat must get by the Bulls. Greg Cody acknowledges that beating Chicago will be more difficult than beating Boston was.
Chicago is a hugely more challenging test for Miami. They've got the reigning MVP in Derrick Rose. They're younger and more athletic than the Celtics were. So I think Chicago is the team that the Heat fears more.
That potentially energizing fear notwithstanding, the mood among fans of the Heat runs from excitement to hysteria, at least according to Greg Cody.
I don't think that South Florida has been as thrilled with one of its pro teams since Dan Marino was in his prime and since the Dolphins last appeared in a Super Bowl in the mid-80s. So this is a Heat town. This is a basketball town, and it's always been a football town before now.
Is there a similar basketball crazy atmosphere in Dallas as the Mavericks prepare to play for the opportunity to advance to the NBA Finals? I asked Jean-Jacques Taylor of the Dallas Morning News about that.
Come on, man. This is football country. It doesn't matter if the Mavericks won 3 straight championships. This is always a Cowboys city. Always will be, and nothing's ever going to change that.
Huh. I wonder if all those football fans have heard about that NFL lockout. Spanish golfer Seve Ballesteros finished second in the British Open in 1976. He was 19 years old. He went on to a career that included 5 major championships and spanned more than 3 decades. Ballesteros died of a brain tumor at the age of 54 last Saturday. His funeral Wednesday in Pedrena, Spain, attracted thousands of mourners and numerous golfers, including Colin Montgomery, Nick Faldo, and Jose Maria Olazabal. Joining me now is Sports Illustrated senior writer and Golf.com columnist Alan Shipnuck. Alan, welcome back to Only a Game.
I'm happy to be here.
Seve Ballesteros won 3 British Opens. He won the Masters twice, all this between 1979 and 88. Jack Nicklaus, Tiger Woods, and many others mentioned his creativity on the golf course in their remembrances of Ballesteros this week. Describe for us the unique style of play that made Ballesteros stand out.
Well, he was Houdini in, you know, soft spikes. The guy was just amazing at extricating himself from trouble. In all these tributes, it's been somewhat overblown how wild he was in his long game. Certainly, he could be crooked, and he'd be in the trees, or he'd be, you know, famously the British Open, he hit into a car park, and he always found a way to save par. No one has ever fought so hard to save par as Seve, probably not until Tiger Woods came along. There was a palpable refusal to ever give in and to accept a bogey. This was an era where you could curve the ball more. You know, the modern golf ball flies a lot straighter. And Seve would play these, you know, 70-yard hook shots around trees, 50-yard cuts around houses. It was just amazing what he could do with a golf ball.
Scotland, England, and Ireland have golf's deepest roots. How is it that a Spaniard wound up playing such an important role in rejuvenating the European influence on the game?
Well, Seve basically made the Ryder Cup what it is today, which is golf Super Bowl and, you know, one of the biggest spectacles in sports. For most of the Ryder Cup's history, it was exactly like you say. It was just the British Isles and Ireland versus the United States. Continental Europe was added in 1979. Seve started playing in the Ryder Cup in the early 80s, and he brought such a fierce determination to beat the Americans and such an incredible passion. The U.S. had always dominated the Ryder Cup. I mean, it was embarrassingly lopsided. The European squad started winning the Ryder Cup with regularity in the 80s into the early 90s, and that's when everyone started paying attention to it. So Seve was really the guy who single-handedly changed the fortunes of the Ryder Cup, and he became the face of the Ryder Cup, and, you know, that clenched jaw and the fist pump and just the smoldering eyes. Nothing brought out his passion like that event.
Probably one of his most memorable victories came not as a player but as the captain of the 1997 European Ryder Cup team. How much did it mean to Ballesteros to win that cup on his native soil?
Well, he always called it his greatest victory. You know, that was the first Ryder Cup played on the continental Europe, and of course that was a tribute to Seve. There was never any doubt there was a package deal. If they were going to take the tournament to Spain, then Seve was going to be the captain. And, you know, the Americans were pretty heavily favored going into that one. That was Tiger Woods' first Ryder Cup. The Europeans had kind of a ragtag bunch. They were transitioning from the stars of Seve's generation. It was just one of the all-time great leadership examples of someone who wasn't even on the field of competition lifting the entire event, lifting his team. And Seve was everywhere. The enduring image of that was he had this golf cart that seemed to travel about 200 miles an hour because he was just everywhere. Whenever there was a critical moment, Stevie would just materialize, whispering in his players' ears or glowering at the Americans. And his force of personality really shaped that event.
Seve Ballesteros was well known to fans of golf here in the U.S., of course, but many Americans might not realize the extent of his dominance on the European Tour, where he won a record 50 titles, and he probably would have won more if he hadn't developed serious back problems.
You know, Seve's prime was before the Golf Channel, and you know, when Seve was dominating the European Tour, there wasn't much coverage in the United States, and so people never truly appreciated just how incredible a player he was. The two green jackets at the Masters brought a level of respect, but he was a week-in, week-out force over there. And long rough and tree-lined courses were not his forte, so he would struggle at the U.S. Open, he'd struggle at the PGA Championship, and Americans never quite got Seve. He was just a player who they didn't get to see often enough to truly appreciate. If Seve Ballesteros was in his prime now, he'd be as big as Tiger Woods ever was. He was a handsome guy. He was a fun character, and just the panache, and you could not take your eyes off of him.
European Tour officials will meet on Tuesday to decide the host of the 2018 Ryder Cup, and Spain is in competition with France, Germany, Portugal, and Holland. Ballesteros' family has urged the committee to award the Cup to Madrid as a tribute to Ballesteros. Is that likely to happen?
I don't think so. You know, the 97 Ryder Cup is still the only one that's been played on the continent, so I think they're going to want to take it to another country. And it would certainly be a nice tip of the cap to Seve, but these things are so much about money and about other factors that the European Tour is not that sentimental. They're going to cut the best deal they can. And, you know, if Seve was around to be the face of that Ryder Cup, even if he wasn't the captain, he would have been, I'm sure, deeply involved. But without Seve, I think, if anything, that hurts their bid.
Alan, give us one last enduring memory of Seve Ballesteros.
His final Ryder Cup as a player was in 1995 at Oak Hill in Rochester, New York, and the quintessential bad golf course for Seve. Thick, rough, narrow fairways, towering trees. So he was playing a singles match against Tom Lehman, who at the time might have been the best ball striker in golf, just hit every fairway, every green. And here was Seve getting lost in the woods on almost every hole. And he sounded like a woodpecker. I mean, his drives were clanging off three or four trees. Search parties were convening to find his shots. And he kept making these absolutely miraculous pars, and Lehman could not shake him. You know, it was such a high wire performance, and ultimately Lehman was just playing too well and he won the match. But in a weird way, that was Seve's greatest day. His desire and his will and his creativity, it was really on full display. And you know, Lehman still talks about that performance and just shakes his head.
Alan Shipnuck is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated and a columnist for Golf.com. Alan, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure.
If you'd like to comment on something you've heard on Only a Game, please leave a message on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 19 minutes past the hour. Nathan Van Sumeren, who plays Australian rules football for a team called Simpsons, was sent off the field during a game in Melbourne last weekend. That wouldn't be much of a story if Van Sumeren's offense had been slugging an opposing player or strenuously arguing a call, but he got the boot for sporting a dangerous haircut. Before the game, the umpire had warned Van Sumeren about his spiky mohawk, but officials had joked about his haircut in the past, so the player didn't give the ump's remarks a thought. Then he got carded and dismissed. The decision has since been ruled, quote, an incorrect interpretation of the rules, which is a good thing for Van Sumeren, since he has no intention of changing his hairstyle.
Got a devil's haircut in my mind. Got a devil's haircut in my mind. Got a devil's haircut in my mind.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, cricket in the classrooms, or at least in the high schools. But first, last week, when President Obama announced that Osama bin Laden had been killed in Pakistan, one of the most controversial reactions came not from a politician or religious leader, but from an athlete. Pittsburgh Steelers running back Rashard Mendenhall used Twitter to chastise those who were celebrating the death of bin Laden and to question whether planes could have taken down the Twin Towers. Those comments cost Mendenhall fans and an endorsement deal, but he's not the only athlete getting into trouble over tweets. Joining me now on the line is Sri Srinivasan, Dean of Student Affairs and Professor at the Columbia School of Journalism. Sri, welcome to Only a Game.
Happy to be here.
You are known for giving companies, journalists, and everyday folks tips for how to use Twitter and other social media. If you were to give a workshop for athletes, what advice would you give?
I would tell them that Twitter has completely changed the way they connect with two of their most important communities. One is with reporters, and the other is with their fans. And what's fascinating is to see how those dynamics all kind of work together in this new changing media landscape.
Because of the NFL lockout, the Steelers could do little more than publicly distance themselves from their outspoken employee. But some, especially those in Pittsburgh, have suggested that players should be banned from all social media. Leagues, of course, already have rules in place about tweeting during games, but do teams have the right to tell their employees what they can and can't say on their own time?
This is something that we are starting to see in all kinds of fields. These athletes are pampered folks with giant egos, so trying to control them is going to be very, very hard. And I don't know if people should be thinking that that's the way to go. What will they really react to? They'll respond to financial incentives and kind of the carrot and stick approach. So what happened with Mendenhall is going to at least be a wake-up call for some athletes, not all of them.
Only a Game listener Brenda Campbell weighed in on our Facebook page saying, and I'm quoting now, like any employer, the team should be able to make clear what it considers inappropriate and job-threatening, but these are athletes we're talking about. How often is there any real threat to their jobs, no matter who they kill, abuse, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Does Ms. Campbell have a point? Are you and I more likely to suffer negative effects for what we tweet than an athlete or celebrity?
I think we've seen that in many, many ways in the last few years. It's also important to remember that we're just getting started, meaning we're still learning what the etiquette is, what the technology is like. And even Twitter itself, I'm remembering a tweet that I saved that Carmelo Anthony sent to Magic Johnson when Magic Johnson joined Twitter, and here was Carmelo Anthony welcoming Magic Johnson, and I'm reading his tweet now. It says, hey, at Magic Johnson, welcome to Twitter. Take some time to get used to. I'm still trying to figure it out, which is absolutely true, that Twitter is not easy to use. I've been on Twitter for 3 years. I still make mistakes all the time. If you ever have the misfortune to sit and watch me tweet, I take 7 to 8 minutes sometimes on a single tweet because I know that what I say on Twitter that day is more likely to be seen by more people than anything else I do that day. I think of kind of that digital trail that I'll have, and I want it to not be as embarrassing as it's going to be anyway.
New Orleans Saints running back Reggie Bush tried to use the just a joke excuse this week when fans reacted negatively to the tweets that he was having fun on his lockout-imposed vacation. Maybe he should have added that little smiley face.
Yeah, you know, this is another example where high-profile people who have lots of followers and lots of people who don't like them will find that people will find the worst interpretation of anything you've ever wanted to say. There are, you know, 100 million plus tweets a day. So you can imagine how this gets paid attention to in ways it may not otherwise.
You know, it's not just American athletes causing controversy on Twitter. Only a Game listener, Jacob Roth, used our Facebook page to alert us to a number of incidents in the English Football Association. He said, and I'm quoting, on the evidence that the FA arguably thinks footballers shouldn't be tweeting at all, I can't wait for the Tweet Responsibly campaigns that will be forthcoming. I wonder what a Tweet Responsibly campaign would look like.
If it's aimed at the athletes, it would say, remember, every tweet you send will be seen by your mother and your grandmother and your and your teacher and then by your agent and by the endorsers. And those endorsement executives are likely to have different standards from you of what is appropriate and what is not. So the next time that you're thinking of sharing a photo from a hot after party you go to, think about that, because everything reflects your image.
Unlike many leagues around the world, the Ultimate Fighting Championship is embracing social media. Starting June the 1st, UFC will offer bonuses for fighters who gain the most Twitter followers, gain the highest percentage of new Twitter followers, and write the most creative tweets. This program will cost UFC $240,000 over the course of a year. Is that a good investment?
Well, let's look at who we're talking about first, right? No surprise when you talk about mixed martial arts as being a different kind of sports league. $240,000 is not a big deal for them if it gets a lot more people talking about, pointing to, and maybe laughing with and laughing at some of their athletes. And so I think this is, for them, from their point of view, I think this makes perfect sense.
Sri Srinivasan has been named one of Pointer's top 35 most influential people in social media. He tweets under the name @SREE. I have been named one of the least 35 influential people in social media. But you can find Only a Game's tweets at Only a Game Radio. Follow us on Facebook the same way. Sri, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you. I'll be following you.
New York's century-old Public Schools Athletic League is known for high school football championships in Yankee Stadium, basketball playoffs at Madison Square Garden, and the budding exploits of famous athletes from Kareem Abdul-Jabbar to Manny Ramirez. Though the league does include games of international flavor like rugby, soccer, and double dutch, the latest PSAL edition is even more exotic. Ron Schachter reports.
The Dr. Charles Drew Athletic Field, with its uneven grassy surfaces and well-worn baseball diamond off in one corner, could pass for any of the dozens of public parks around New York City's five boroughs. What's not so typical about this park in Queens is the central location of a wicket, three closely spaced sticks pounded into the ground and separated from another wicket by a dirt strip about 3 yards wide and 25 yards long.
Catch it! Go ahead!
It's on this patch of parkland, or pitch to be technical, that the newly minted cricket team from the nearby High School for Construction, Trades, Engineering, and Architecture takes batting practice. The batsmen connecting with the bouncing ball and ambling between the two wickets look more like hockey goalies in their huge leg pads, thick gloves, and caged helmets. They carry their angular bats by their sides as they run back and forth.
Attack it! Throw it in!
Eric Goldstein, the league's chief executive officer, says that offering cricket was an idea whose time had come, thanks to the city's ever-growing population of families from cricket-playing countries such as Bangladesh, Pakistan, India, Trinidad, and Guyana.
The city changes. Neighborhoods change. And as an organization, we have to be responsive to that and to provide the opportunities for the children to be involved in school and by extension in the athletic programs that the schools offer. So they're just as much as part of the city as we are. The PSAL has always been innovative. We've added sports all the time. So let's see if cricket will work, and it's been just a resounding success.
14 schools fielded competitive teams in 2009. By this season, that number had expanded to 26, with over 400 players, including the new High School for Construction squad.
Out! Ball 'em!
After batting practice on this windy Friday afternoon, first-year coach Jason Salamanca gathers his team, almost entirely composed of freshmen and sophomores. Salamanca, who along with most of the PSAL's cricket coaches never played the game, already knows the importance of making contact at all costs with the thrown ball, lest it slip by the batter and hit the wicket behind him for an out, and to avoid popping the ball into the air where an opposing fielder could easily grab it and end the at-bat.
Now, the last match, I remember you guys, Kiefer went out pretty quickly, right? All right? That cannot happen. You have to try to stay out there as long as possible, be as conservative as possible. Too many guys out there hacking away. You can't be doing that.
For the finer points of cricket, Salamanca relies on the team's sophomore Trinidadian captain, who offers advice on batting orders and defensive positioning, as well as a continuing education in cricket terminology.
When I first came here, I was asking who's the pitchers. He said there are no pitchers, they're bowlers. Who's a catcher? There are no catchers, they're wicketkeepers.
American-born sophomore Dean Halloran is also new to the sport, but his experience playing baseball and running track has earned him a starting position on the cricket team.
I didn't actually like cricket at first. I didn't know the sport, I didn't understand it, but one day my track coach actually asked me to try it out. I did, and actually I enjoy it.
Assistant coach Anthony Chatrim launches pop-ups to the barehanded high school for construction fielders, who try to cradle the red rawhide ball without dropping it or bruising themselves.
Two!
Dive! Superman!
Chatrim starred for and graduated from neighboring Richmond Hill High School. Last year, Richmond Hill produced the league's MVP and went undefeated before losing the championship game. Chatrim says that the players he's coaching today have a ways to go defensively, especially when it comes to getting a jump on the ball and then some.
I used to go home with the most dirtiest clothes. One match I dived, I had cuts all over my arms. Another match I ran into the umpire because I'm running for the ball, and he didn't go out the way, so I ended up knocking him over. You have to sacrifice your body in order if you want to win.
There's no knocking over the dignified-looking umpire the following morning when the captains from John Bowne High School, another first-year team, and more experienced Sheepshead Bay, meet for the coin flip in the middle of the cricket pitch at Brooklyn's Marine Park.
And the visiting team, what do they call him? Spin?
Tails.
Tail it is.
The John Bowne team features one of the league's several female players. Tennille Rushmarsing played cricket in her native Trinidad until she was 12. She took up softball when her family moved to the United States. Now she's returned to her favorite sport and is holding her own with the boys. But Rushmarsing is more impressed with this team's chemistry and the international barriers it's helped remove.
It creates some sort of melting pot, and you see it more so on the team than in school, because in school you see a lot of cliques, maybe, you know, whoever you feel comfortable hanging out. But once you join a team, you have to learn to, you know, embrace every culture. And I never hung out with, you know, people from Afghanistan or India, stuff like that. And I learned how hard it is or how difficult or how easy it is to associate with them. And they were very, very welcoming.
As the players from John Bowne and Sheepshead Bay take the field, they stand out against the grass in their traditional bright white uniforms. The similarities end there, as the stronger Sheepshead Bay batsmen deftly meet almost every ball on a short hop and spray hits all over the circular field.
Beautiful!
They pile up runs as they commute between the two wickets and intermittently launch fly balls beyond the boundary line 60 yards away. Each of those hits good for 6 runs.
Nice. Come on!
There aren't mercy rules in this cricket league, and Sheepshead Bay prevails 226-87, one of the most lopsided results of the PSAL season so far. That's not the result that cricket coordinator Lorna Austin is focused on. Austin points to the difference that cricket is making in these students' lives.
You watch a game, they're so into it, they're cheering, they're jumping, because they're not participating in the traditional sports that we have going on. And they were so happy that cricket, which is of their culture, is now part of the school system, and they were very excited about it.
Today, the High School for Construction, Trades, Engineering, and Architecture takes on DeWitt Clinton. John Bowne's next contest takes place Monday against Stuyvesant. The PSAL's regular season concludes at the end of this month, with playoffs to follow in early June. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter.
You're listening to Only a Game. When a wage earner's wages fluctuate, and sometimes even when that just seems to be about to happen, the wage earner makes adjustments, or has adjustments thrust upon him or her. This is as true of players in the National Football League as it is of anybody else who works for a living. It's also as true of pro football players as it is of any other fellow similarly attached or previously attached that alimony and child support payments are inclined to rise and fall according to income. When it's falling that happens, you cannot get blood out of a turnip, whether the turnip sells insurance, teaches geometry, or jumps on footballs. So it's not surprising that according to a widely read and very widely commented upon article published this week on Bloomberg.com, that numbers of NFL players have been trying to arrange for more modest payments to various people they've been required to support. This might be characterized as preemptive action, since normally, even absent a lockout, NFL players aren't paid in May. Unless their agents have arranged for advances on bonuses or salary, players receive their checks during the season. And the premise of the story itself might be characterized as unfair and misleading, since the pro football players exploring the possibility of adjusting downward their financial obligations are only doing what jobless or potentially jobless stockbrokers, bankers, and corporate executives too insignificant to qualify for golden handshakes have always done. But NFL players earn an average of $1.8 million annually, and NBA players, who are anticipating a lockout of their own next month, average almost $6 million, so they are likely subjects for stories about money that is and then suddenly isn't, which is a popular subject. Beyond that, a relatively small number of pro football and basketball players have been spectacularly prolific in the production of children, and accordingly, their associates in the games have sometimes been unfairly characterized as generally profligate in that area. Still, dubious as some of them have been, this week's stories of women and children as potential victims of the lockout does more thoroughly establish the context within which that lockout is continuing. Like all big businesses, the NFL supports a lot of people peripheral to the enterprise itself, not only purveyors of bad food and warm beer and marketers of large foam fingers, but also the partners and progeny of the players. It all adds up to another reason to hope that whatever petitions for relief the players have been filing will become irrelevant by the time they are scheduled to get paid again. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Harvard University, whose summer school has courses for high school, college, and adults to earn academic credit and experience campus life, summer.harvard.edu, and Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
Some house cats purr more loudly than others, and the loudest cat of them all is Smokey, who belongs to a London woman named Ruth Adams. For reasons best known to herself, Ms. Adams brought Smokey to a community college where somebody was willing and perhaps even eager to record the cat's purr, which has been described as, quote, a sound akin to the cooing of an angry dove. Having dispatched the tape to Guinness, not the beer people, the record book people, Ms. Adams and her colleagues breathlessly waited for news. As far as the Guinness people could determine, no domestic cat had ever purred more powerfully than Smokey, who probably responded to the news by making, quote, a sound akin to the cooing of an angry dove, and woke everybody up. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, my conversation with Robert Lipsight about his memoir, An Accidental Sports Writer. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
It's been 19 years since the Boston Bruins made it as far as the Eastern Conference Championships. It's been a considerably shorter time for the Tampa Bay Lightning, who won the Stanley Cup in 2004. Does any of this matter this time around?
Well, remember the distinction that the Tampa Bay Lightning has.
Mm-hmm.
They're the only team ever to win the Stanley Cup one year and retain it without ever having to play for it the following year.
Thanks to brilliant skills on the part of those who run the
negotiators, exactly. They were the holdover NHL disappears, Stanley Cup champions.
Mm-hmm.
I don't imagine it matters much, the fact that there isn't a lot of history between these two teams. It's a fascinating series. The Bruins are playing it absolutely at the top of their game right now. And Tampa Bay's got one of the weirdest stats I've ever seen. Almost all of their offense comes either on the power play or while killing penalties.
Mm-hmm.
It's a ludicrous amount of the offense, and at least in the previous series, came in when one team or the other was shorthanded.
The San Jose Sharks had lost three straight potentially series-clinching games against the Detroit Red Wings before finally advancing on Thursday. Starting tomorrow, the Sharks will face Vancouver in the Western Conference Finals. Which team has the advantage there?
I think Vancouver does. I think Vancouver is going to play for and win the Stanley Cup this year. Although it was good to see San Jose finally get over this seventh game thing. Joe Thornton actually played like he knew what he was doing in the playoffs, as did Patrick Marleau.
New York Rangers forward Sean Avery is in the news this week for taking a stand in support of gay marriage. One Canadian broadcaster has lost his job for agreeing with the sports agent who disagreed with Avery's position. Politics aside, should anybody be losing a job over this?
No, this is corporate media enforcing these what they insist and maintain are called ethics codes, which are really called speech codes and ought to be called please don't write us nasty email codes. There's absolutely no reason for this guy to have lost his job. I don't agree with the guy's position. I applaud Sean Avery for taking the position he did. But certainly nobody in a broadcast or even quasi-journalistic medium should lose his job because somewhere outside of their work they expressed an opinion. That's offensive. That's what happens when you hand this industry over to bean counters and cowards.
Everybody who thought they'd see the Celtics play the Lakers for the NBA championship once again this spring has had to find another matchup to anticipate. I realize it's just the Eastern Conference championship, Charlie, but the series starting tomorrow between the Chicago Bulls and the Miami Heat should offer some solace, don't you think?
Oh, I think it's going to be a terrific series. I think Chicago got shook a little bit by Atlanta because Atlanta was a very tough matchup for the Bulls. But I think when you've got the obvious stars of the Heat and Derrick Rose, who finally was named the league MVP and should have been, I think this is going to showcase some wonderful, wonderful basketball.
I'm telling you, I root for Dallas from here on in. And
why
I root, is that? I root for 53-pointers the next time they play. I thought that was one of the more entertaining games I've ever seen when they beat the Lakers with all those three-point shots.
I kept waiting for them to stop it and hand somebody a stuffed dolphin or something.
The Lakers really made a mess of their departure from the playoffs. Lamar Odom and Andrew Bynum were both tossed from the final game for egregious fouls. Bynum apologized, but throwing that elbow into J.J. Barea turned out to be an expensive move.
Yeah, $25,000 fine and probably a suspension at the beginning of the year. Plus, he took off his shirt, he acted like a jackass, and he completely devalued himself as an NBA player. There was a lot of talk that Orlando would trade Dwight Howard as opposed to losing him to free agency sometime before the end of next season. And one of the places they talked about was trading him to the Lakers for Andrew Bynum. That deal, I would imagine, is dead at this point.
In the latest legal wrinkle involving the NFL lockout, the players have politely asked a federal judge to award them $707 million of the dollars that were headed for the pockets of the owners. Given the way this lockout has been progressing, are you surprised they didn't just go ahead and ask for, $4 billion?
$4 billion! I think what will happen here is the players will win in District Judge David Doty's court, probably lose on appeal, and this will be yet another one of the 25-track litigation strategy that both sides seem to be pursuing.
Remember those stories about how quarterback Cam Newton was for sale to the highest bidding college? Because apparently there will soon be some statuesque evidence that those stories count for naught at Auburn University.
Auburn's going to put up a statue to him, and why not? He got them a national championship. If they paid for it, they got what they paid for.
That is the most straightforward interpretation of that circumstance I've heard yet.
All books are in balance, my friend.
Never mind the multi-million-dollar scandal, there will be a Tostitos Fiesta Bowl next winter. This leads me to wonder how much criminal activity has to be associated with a college bowl game before it gets blown up.
Well, it depends. If it's the players, we have national scandals and total disgrace, and let's put these miserable young miscreants in the stocks. If you're a bunch of fat guys who are tied in with the corporate class who wear blazers, you find them $1 million, which is boutonniere money for these people, and you move right along.
The line between pharmacological treatment necessary to heal an athlete and pharmacological treatment meant to enhance the athlete's performance has always been hard to establish. How should
we? But by God, we're going to fall all over ourselves trying.
Grab a hammer and let's go to it. How should we regard the stem cell treatment received by Yankees pitcher Bartolo Colon.
As a medical miracle, I hope he gets back and pitches. And I mean, we need more evidence that this whole drug frenzy is making people stupid. The fact that this is a controversy and that Major League Baseball is looking into it. Suppose in 1963, Bill, we could have had a surgery that would guarantee us 9 more years of Sandy Koufax mm-hmm. at the top of his game. How in heaven's name is that bad?
I'm with you all the way, except I was a Giants fan.
Well, that's a problem, but...
There's a world record for everything, and in Nature's Valley, South Africa, Scott Huntley, originally from Scotland, set his world record. I'm guessing that his accomplishment involved precisely as many ups as downs.
Well no. See, I don't know that that's true, and the account of it is incomplete. He completed 105 bungee jumps in a 7.5-hour period. The video I've seen of bungee jumping, because I have no intention of bungee jumping myself, you sort of like hang there and bounce for a while before they haul you up.
Yeah.
So I'm not exactly sure if this guy just did the one thing and then started up, or if he let the momentum, you know, carry him for a few. He did point out that he only stopped twice, and that was to go to the toilet, and I think if you're bungee jumping, that's a heck of an idea.
Charlie
and
Pierce.
So, by the way, to the little woodland critters below.
Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America and several other books. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
In his memoir titled An Accidental Sports Writer, Robert Lipsight writes, "Sports writing isn't the oldest profession, although it is sometimes conducted that way." When Lipsight himself began writing about baseball players and boxers, he was determined not to become one of those sports writers who, quote, adore the events themselves and the heady access. Robert Lipsight joins me from NPR's New York Bureau. Welcome to Only a Game, or I should say welcome back to Only a Game.
Yeah, I'm glad you let me play again.
You began writing about sports more than 50 years ago. How soon did it become apparent to you that most of the newspaper sports writers were, quote, lodge brothers inclined to adore the events rather than function as reporters?
Well, I understood it pretty quickly, I think, but... I mean, these Lodge brothers really took me under their wing. They mm-hmm. were wonderful. Jimmy Cannon, Red Smith, Arthur Daly. I mean, I was no threat, obviously. and I really didn't know that much about sports. Very quickly, I understood that the wonderful access that we had in those days came with a terrible price. That was, you could drink with the player or the coach that night at the bar, but you would never write about the bimbo he went upstairs with. and in a kind of a larger sense, you never really told the reader, the fan, who these people really were and what this was really all like.
One of the earliest experiences you had regarding how unpleasant heroic baseball players could be came courtesy of former New York Yankees center fielder Mickey Mantle. Tell us what happened when you asked Mr. Mantle about a fan who'd hit him in the jaw.
Well, he just very casually, and this is very casually, no malice or velocity, he just very casually looked over his shoulder and he made a rude and impossible suggestion. Actually, I reframed the question because I felt it was my bad, and he and Yogi Berra began throwing the ball an inch over my head. which I realize meant the interview's over. But it took me a while because I felt so humiliated. I asked a more experienced reporter, and he just kind of looked at me and said, welcome to the club. That's our Mickey. You should see him spit at kids who want autographs. And I go, why don't you ever write about that? Well, our readers don't want to read that, which is probably true.
You begin your memoir with a story about how you were bullied when you were a child. How did that experience inform your attitude when you began writing about professional athletes?
Well, you know, I've only really started thinking about that recently, and you are now one of my therapists in waiting. I guess it did. And I guess that my reaction to Mickey Mantle was an overreaction. You know, I should have said, well, he's a jerk, or he's having a bad day, or whatever, and just kind of moved on to it. But I immediately went into, you know, the fat boy mode, and, you know, this bully, and I was angry for years. You know, 25 years later, I'm interviewing Mantle in an abandoned country club bar. He had spent the whole day with, you know, executives. He had been paid to drink and play golf with them. Joker Stroke Golf, it's called.
Mm-hmm.
And he's pretty drunk by now. And we're having this really terrible interview. It's boring. He's dull. I figured, what the hell? Let's either shake it up or end it now. And I said, you know, Mick, I've never liked you. And his kind of eyes widened. And I told him the story. And he looked at me and he gave me that wonderful country grin. He raised his glass and he said, you know, I remember that really well, Bob. It's bothered me all these years. And that's the reason I became a drunk. And at that moment, I got Mickey Mantle.
Yeah.
I understood why Yankees thought he was a wonderful teammate. So after that, I started to become a Mickey Mantle fan.
Another of the athletes who influenced you was Muhammad Ali. When he was still fighting, did you ever get a clear sense of when you should take him seriously and when you should ignore him or just laugh?
You know, I'm not sure that there were clear delineations. I mean, he would say things, you know, which you couldn't get into the paper and maybe can't get on this broadcast. If you gave him a compliment, for example, he would just shrug and he would say, I'm just a nigger trying to get bigger. Can you imagine Muhammad Ali would say that? And the most famous thing that he ever said, I ain't got no quarrel with them Viet Cong. I happened to have been there the first time he said it. He had just found out that moment that his draft deferment had been canceled.
Mm-hmm.
He could be drafted now. And his first reaction was, why me? Why don't they draft all those poor boys in Louisville? Look at all the taxes I pay to buy them tanks and guns and airplanes. And in the course of a day, you know, where there were dozens and dozens of interviews of people hammering at him, you know, how do you feel about Vietnam? How do you feel about the Viet Cong? Do you know where Vietnam was? Of course he didn't. And finally, at the end of the evening, finally the last radio reporter says, so, champ, what do you think about going and killing some Viet Cong? And he said, I ain't got nothing against them Viet Cong.
Mm-hmm.
And boom, everybody saw the headline.
At one of the points where you became pretty disillusioned with writing about athletes and games, you got jump-started, as you put it, by NASCAR. How did that happen?
Well, this is my second hitch at the Times, and in a sense, I became an accidental sports writer all over again. Neil Amdro, the editor of the sports editor of the paper, had this wonderful idea to kind of refresh myself in the column, that I'd find a sport I knew nothing about. There were several, but NASCAR particularly. And so the idea was that, you know, as a dilettante anthropologist, I would go down to redneck heaven. And I went down there, met Dale Earnhardt, who was a fascinating character, became entranced by the technology and economics. I really loved the people because, you know, you cover baseball or football, you ask somebody a basic question, they'll kind of say, why doesn't your editor send somebody who knows something? In NASCAR, they'll sit down and explain what a restrictor plate is and, you know, show you the inside of an engine. I mean, a driver will do this. So I was really besotted. I loved NASCAR. And then the first race I actually covered, the Daytona 500 in February of 2001, Dale Earnhardt hit the wall right under where I was sitting. There had been wrecks before in that race and people walked away. I didn't really take it seriously until all of a sudden the ground crew ran out and threw a blue tarp over his car. And the moment that happened, people in the press box began crying. And the 200,000 in the stands, there was kind of an animal gasp. They all knew, which I did not, that Earnhardt was dead.
Regarding the failure of most baseball writers to say anything about steroids during the summer when Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa were breaking the home run record, you write, and I'm quoting here, they left it alone not out of laziness or stupidity, but rather in the sweet moral corruption of love. Have any of your former colleagues taken issue with that theory?
No, because it's true. I hate to immodestly say I was right, but I was right. It wasn't venal. It was the feeling that baseball, their sport, their livelihood, was in a sense bringing the country back together after the horrors of the blue dress and the Republicans attacking Clinton and some really, you know, kind of nasty things happening in the society at large. Here we were coming together. This was all fun. As Murray Chass said, yeah, you could be investigative, but that wouldn't be fun. It was all jolly, and who wanted to rain on this delicious parade?
Longtime sports writer and columnist Robert Lipsight is the author of An Accidental Sports Writer, published by HarperCollins. The author joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Bob, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill, and I'll write another book so I can come back sometime.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Mark Filippino, to whom we bid a fond adios. Best of luck with life beyond the candy store. Special thanks this week to technical subdirector Paul Vikas. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Ron Schachter's New York Cricket Photo Gallery or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Dallas Morning News sports writer Jean-Jacques Taylor, who offers wisdom to anybody following the NBA postseason.
You know, it's not the glass is half full, it's not half empty, it's a half a glass of water.
Or in the case of any NBA team, half a glass of insert product placement here. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting Games for Health, working to use video games to improve health at rwjf.org/pioneer. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.